From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. From more than a century on, the Victorian age can look appealing and repellent. What was it like to live there, to be there morning, noon, and night? Chamber pot, top hat, hooped skirt, cup of tea, and the industrial age roaring to life. This hour on Point, a historian's guide, how to be a Victorian. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you think of when you think of Victorian England? Is it a life you'd like to live? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Oxford, England, is Ruth Goodman, historian, author of the new book, How to Be a Victorian, a dawn-to-dusk guide to Victorian life. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. She is well known in the UK for her reality shows on the BBC, including Victorian Farm, where she recreates and lives on a Victorian farm for a year, Victorian Pharmacy, where she helps run a Victorian-era pharmacy, and more. She's a consultant to the Victoria and Albert Museum. Ruth Goodman, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
I love the time travel that you offer us here. What's the biggest what's the biggest mind twister in recreating or reliving actual, as close as you can come, Victorian life?
Oh, for me, it's just dealing with the cold. That is absolutely it. I adore modern central heating with a passion that nobody who's never lived without it could possibly understand.
But we've seen all these grates and fireplaces in big houses, in fancy houses
still
anyway, right
cold.
Up in the bedroom. Did they light them up?
Yeah, but they never light them. And most people couldn't afford that much coal for a first place. And generally, if you lit a fire in the bedroom, it was because somebody was sick. So that they carried a lot of overtones of illness. You know, even in the greatest, grandest of houses, very few bedroom fires were lit ever.
And you remind us that high born or low, rich or poor, everybody kept their windows open in their bedrooms through the night. Why was that?
Well, you don't want to die.
Well, why would you die?
Well, there was an awful lot of medical theory that was looking into the way that bodies worked. And what they were noticing was how much carbon dioxide was coming off people. And they were feeling that in a sealed room, you would use up all the oxygen. You would, endanger your health. I mean, perhaps no normal domestic space is quite sealed enough for you to actually asphyxiate. I can't say the word. To actually my voice has gone completely. But it was felt that the build-up of carbon dioxide within that space was deeply dangerous to health. There was a very famous experiment in which somebody put a canary over a four-poster bed, and the canary is supposed to have been dead by morning. So people were absolutely paranoid about this idea of not enough fresh air. Windows, therefore, had to be wide open.
Drop a 21st century listener down in Victorian London. You pick the year. What would most immediately leap to mind, to our senses, to our observation as, I am in a different world?
Yeah, the soot. We've had clean air for some time now, and there's not many people alive who really remember what it was like. My father talks quite a lot about the great smogs. He remembers the last few in London. But almost any city, almost any town, indeed even quite small villages, the soot hanging in the air was the thing that I think you would notice first. Great huge flakes of it, almost like black sticky snow, drifting down and sticking to everything they touched.
And this from coal, was it also from...
It's from huge amounts of coal being burnt domestically, industrially, and combining in the atmosphere to create sort of sulfuric acids as well, so that it came down acidic, sticky and black. And in our towns and cities, very little plant life could grow. It was so noxious that, I mean, London to this day has basically one species of tree, and that was the London plane tree, which was the only one that could cope, that could stay alive in that much pollution.
Did the Victorians complain about it? Did they complain bitterly, or did they think this is the sign of modernity?
I think they sort of took it for granted, like you couldn't be helped. You know, it had built slowly over generation after generation after generation. As we in Britain moved from being a wood-burning nation, say back in the 16th century, to being a coal-burning nation. And it had built little by little by little. So it was absolutely taken for granted. I mean, when I was looking for evidence of this, yes, medical people talked about it, and yes, there were estimates of the number of people who died from it. But the most common discussions of the air actually happened in gardening manuals, which is why I mentioned the plane trees. So if you moved somewhere that wasn't in the main concentration, if you moved out into the so-called clean suburbs, or you were in a small town, there was still enough pollution in the air to ensure that you got no black spot on your roses. So you'd grow beautiful roses, but there were a whole range of plants you couldn't grow because it was simply too polluted. You had to be way out in the wilds before they would grow.
I love the way you take a reader from early morning right through the day in a very up-close and personal sort of style, describing what it was to be Victorian. Get us up and out of bed. Get us dressed. Start with, if it had been yourself, a woman in the Victorian age, rising, dressing, washing.
Well, there's not a huge amount of washing, not in the modern sense. The idea of washing in hot soapy water is one that arrives during the Victorian period. And for most of that period, people were a bit nervous about it. You know, there'd been centuries of advice saying that opening your pores was positively dangerous.
And water would do that.
And water would do that, particularly hot water. Mm-hmm. So, you know, people were a little nervous. Cold water, fine. So for most of the Victorian period, if people are being advised to wash, they're being advised to wash in cold water.
There's not a shower, forget that. It's typically a pitcher and a bowl, and you're standing in your bedroom.
You're standing in your bedroom wearing very little, and the window is probably open, even if the curtains are drawn. So it's darn nippy. You've got a flannel, you've got a jug of water and a bowl, and you just basically have to sort of wash yourself down with the flannel and then dry yourself off with a towel. But even that was a little bit, you know, new as an idea. So that at the very beginning of Queen Victoria's reign, you find that very few people indeed are even having a stand-up wash in a bowl. They're mostly just doing their hands and face and feet. And the rest of it, well, you just have to manage without. And it's only as time goes on that more and more people start to even have the wash with the bowl. After all, people didn't accept that disease was spread by germs until the 1840s, 1850s.
There's almost nothing you can discuss out of this era that isn't class-related somehow. I read the washing here, it really depends what your means were. And there were not like today when pretty much everybody has access to a shower somewhere. Yeah. Not so then, even a pitcher of water, it could be a very different story.
Absolutely. It was a very, very divided society and a very poor society. Even those people we think of as being better off actually had considerably less to eat than most of us do now. They, you know, had to scrimp and save to have enough clothes. And that's people we would call middle class, let alone those at the bottom.
Dress a Victorian woman. Let's say, I mean, one might be going off to work in a factory. Another might be rising to a day in a big house. What are they wearing?
Underneath everything comes what was called a chemise, which was a polite term for a sort of nighty thing. It covers you from your elbows to your neck and down to your knees.
But without a sexy connotation, you're right.
Without any sexy connotations at all. Nice plain white cotton, very simple. And then over that, there goes a corset, and this is a deeply important garment. It was felt not just to give you a shape, you can understand perhaps you might want to wear it for fashion, but more importantly, it was to give you moral rectitude. It was felt that by being corseted, a woman learnt self-control, inward and outward.
I'm having trouble following that. I get the Spanx part of it, I guess, the shaping part, but moral rectitude from... the steel ribs of a corset around your middle?
Yeah.
Why?
I know, it's a strange idea, but it was very much about self-control, about controlling appetite, controlling the body, making sure that you were always the person in control, not your body being in control of you.
You're right, and it's very interesting that in the Victorian age, everybody wanted to be seen standing very upright, sitting very upright. A corset made it much easier to do that. You're sitting in
so
a kind of superstructure.
Yeah, I know. I mean, you don't have to put any effort into it. If you're wearing a corset, there is no slouching. You inside can be as floppy as you like. You can just go, but the corset makes you, it just sort of holds you there. So you look as elegant as heck. But In fact, you're putting no effort into it whatsoever. And as I say, everybody wore them. There's sometimes a feeling that it's only, you know, at the top end of society. But in workhouses and in prisons, we've got records of the overseers of the poor and the prison governors issuing corsets to women inmates. So, you know, everybody is wearing it. Working class women, no matter what job you're doing, whether you're mucking out the pigs or scrubbing the floors, you're doing it in a corset. How tightly you lace it, well, that's more up to you.
They literally came to believe that women did not have the same musculature in their abdomen to sort of hold all their organs.
That seems absurd. Women are the weaker vessel. We call it loves. We can't cope.
Right. But you do describe how, after wearing a corset for a few days, your muscles do get weakened because the corset's doing the work. Your muscles aren't. And
it takes more than a few days. But yeah, I mean, when I did the year on the farm, we did a year on the farm, mm-hmm. and then we had to do some more filming after that. So by the time we'd finished, it was nearly 18 months that I wore that corset. And I wore it from, say, about 7 in the morning till about 10 or 11 at night, day in, day out.
Did Victorian women feel put upon by having to do that?
No, I don't think they did, or at least they don't. They don't record those feelings. Mostly what people record are sort of, you know, feelings of feeling attractive. Some women found them very helpful and supportive. And many of them believed all this business about moral rectitude. You know, it's not being put on from outside. People believe that themselves. And they also believe that being able to hold yourself up. And it is so. After that period of corset wearing for me, you did find that my whole muscle tone in my abdomen all the way around had gone really floppy.
Ruth Goodman, Please Stand By, in Oxford in the UK. The new book is How to Be a Victorian, A Dawn to Dusk Guide to Victorian Life. Behind us right here, Daisy, Daisy, you know the song, 1892, popular in London music halls. We'll look at those. Ruth, stand by. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Daisy, Daisy, give me your answer door. I'm half crazy, all for the love of you. It won't be a stylish marriage. I can't afford a carriage. But you'll look sweet on the seat.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about how to be a Victorian with the British historian Ruth Goodman. She tells us all about life in the Victorian age, hygiene, habits, fashion, diet, bedtime, pony hair, toothbrushes, in her book, How to Be a Victorian, A Dawn to Dusk Guide to Victorian Life. Joins us from Oxford. She's well known in the UK for her kind of reality shows, historic recreations. She's lived the life. Here she was in the series Victorian Farm.
Ruth Goodman, Alex Langlands, and Peter Ginn are taking up the challenge of living as Victorian farmers for a full calendar year, from the depths of winter to the warmth of summer. They'll wear the clothes, eat the food, and experience the day-to-day life of rural Victorians.
Like Survivor, but different. Ruth Goodman is with us today from Oxford. Ruth Goodman's just getting us up and out of bed. The ladies have their corsets on. There's more to come, hoops and you name it. What about the men, Ruth? Would it have been odd or familiar for a 21st century man to be dressing in Victorian England?
Well, there'd probably be a few more layers than you're used to. I mean, the most fundamental is that you know, men didn't put, you call them pants, don't they? We call them trousers.
Either way.
They wouldn't put that over bare legs. The idea of putting your pants on over bare legs would have seemed disgusting. They always had an underlayer.
Even in the summertime?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, all year round. Usually wool if you could afford it, because that was felt to be the most healthy of fibres next to your skin.
Wool undergarments in the summertime?
Yep.
That sounds horrible. Why?
Because it was believed that wool was a natural insulator, that it wicked all the sweat and the damp away from the skin and allowed it, a natural perspiration to occur. So that was felt to be very healthy, that it helped to draw toxins out of the body. In fact, so much did the Victorian man and woman believe in woolen underwear that if you go through the great expeditions of the 19th century, the great explorers, you'll find that not only did Scott of the Antarctic and indeed Shackleton have woolly underwear, but so too did Dr. Livingstone in the middle of Africa.
Oh, Lord. You describe them changing this stuff, some of them, if you're in the right position in society, I guess, several times a day, that they kind of just don't bathe, just take away those underclothes, put on fresh ones, and you're good to go.
Yeah, absolutely. And it does sort of work.
Have you tried it?
I have tried it. I actually went through a 3-month period in which I wore just linen underwear underneath modern clothes. And that was it. I did nothing else. I just didn't wash in any way, shape or form, changed the underwear daily and rubbed myself down with a cloth, and nobody noticed.
The ladies, back to them, these enormous skirts, just huge, huge clothing, it looks to a modern eye.
Yeah.
A lot of structural work to make these things take the form that was expected.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a real instance of fashion and technology going hand in hand. So at the beginning of Victoria's reign, skirts are getting bigger and people are doing more and more petticoats, and they're trying to use all sorts of different starchy things to make the petticoats stand out. So they start using horsehair, and that's still not enough. The word crinoline is actually horsehair. It's from the Latin. Mm. And then a new way of making steel hoops arrives. And then suddenly you can have a humongous skirt without the weight of all those petticoats. And women go, yes, that's what we want. Fashion will go even bigger. But it could never have happened without the technological leap in the making of steel. And then, of course, the crinoline factories just like zoom into production. So many were made that it was estimated at one point that there must be 3 crinolines in every woman's wardrobe.
And at the same time, or along come, chemical dyes with an explosion of colour, which was widely, deeply embraced.
Absolutely. The 1860s, the world just began to look utterly different. It was an accidental find almost, and people were beginning to experiment with coal and what you could break it down into, well, the chemicals that could come from coal particularly. I mean, if you think of our modern world, it's almost entirely made out of oil, isn't it? Everything around you, look at all the plastics and things, what you're wearing, what you're holding, what you're touching, it's bound to have got something made out of oil in it. And the Victorian world was already doing that, but with coal. They were finding all these super chemicals, and the colours came out of this chemical explosion. They're so bright. I mean, because of black and white photography, we've all got this image of Victorian Britain and America as being a bit grey.
But black and white in silhouette or something.
Yeah, exactly. But as soon as you look at the surviving clothes, what really hits you is, whoa, they're like, you know, 1970s psychedelia. Bang is their colour.
Mark in Fort Lauderdale, you're on with Ruth Goodman. Her book is How to Be a Victorian. What's your question, Mark?
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my question.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, what was the standard for beauty for women in the 19th century?
Standard for beauty. Ruth.
Hi, Mark. Well, it was about the natural look. Anybody who looked painted or made up was considered to be old-fashioned and dirty. It was associated with the late 18th century of slightly rakish roués who perhaps might have caught venereal disease. It had become associated with the sorts of bad living from overindulgence that might have gone on amongst the elite in the late 18th century. And nobody wanted anything to do with that. So a beautiful Victorian woman was supposed to be absolutely natural. No hint of any artifice. Although when you start looking at the women's magazines, there's loads of cheats and things as to how to produce it using a whole range of products. But you were supposed to be aiming at an utterly natural look with a teeny tiny waist. You were supposed to be very slim and very petite.
Natural look, but the clothes or anything but. I mean, they're enormous and wonderful. What about the men? They had these exaggerated things as well. You described 14-inch top hats.
Yes, enormously high. Fashions for men change quite a lot. Again, we get this image that men's fashion doesn't move very much, and most of the images we see tend to be of chaps in dark coats, you know, in those photographs. But again, when you look more closely, the range of looks available to a bloke were huge, particularly in where he wore his hair and his beard. So we get a really strong set of fashions that said different things about you. So there's a period at the very beginning in which you have all your hair brushed forwards into like little curly locks. masks that come round the face, which is a very modern look. Mm. And then we get all these different beards. So initially you get a sort of like sideburns look. And then that turns into a rim beard, goes around the edges of the face. Think Abraham Lincoln. Mm-hmm. You know, like the bit around his nose and mouth is very carefully shaven, but there's that rim around. And that sort of said, hey, look, I'm a man, I can grow a beard, but I'm also a civilized man who can maintain it in a shaped way. Yes. You know, it's quite a sophisticated sort of idea. And then in the middle of the century, we get a short period in which the bigger the beard, the better, the more masculine. And you see that especially amongst laboring men and also amongst intellectual men who I think were feeling the need to express their masculinity. People like Darwin, you know, huge beard. And then that gradually recedes. So there was an enormous amount of change in men's appearance, and it mattered to them.
We have felt back in that era, beard-wise, in the United States lately. I don't know about the UK, Ruth, but they're sprouting all over the place here. John in Austin, Texas. John, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Oh, hi, Tom. It was a very interesting show, very interesting concept. I was wondering, most of the remarks so far seem to have been kind of focusing on England and perhaps London, but, you know, maybe southern England. Was this, would you say that there were regional differences in Victorian style, say, within the United Kingdom, like Scotland, Edinburgh, Wales, Cardiff?
That's a really good question. That's a really good question. And the answer is, yes, there were, but they're gradually losing. So if we start at the beginning of the period, you could tell where somebody came from by one glance. And by the end, it was getting much more difficult. And that's as, you know, things like the sewing machine come in and start to produce situations where mass-produced clothes can be made. And, you know, transport begins to be able to move these mass-produced goods more thoroughly right across the nation and indeed the world. So if you were to look in 1840, you would be able to tell if somebody was from Wales, if somebody was from Scotland, if somebody was from the northeast or the northwest. There was a separate sort of look that seemed to happen down in the south of London as opposed to the Midlands. You'd be able to spot that fairly easily. You certainly also got a huge dichotomy between the people who lived in towns, who mostly wore darker colours, and the people who lived rurally, who mostly wore lighter colours. But all of that gradually got faded out as the years progressed, because it's a long period, the Victorian era.
You describe it, of course, the 60 years of Queen Victoria's reign, and you describe it encompassing, you say, vast social, political, and economic changes, and industries rose and fell, scientific revolutions overturned the old understanding of how the world worked. Did those 19th century Victorians think of themselves as living in a maelstrom of change?
Oh, yes. Yes, definitely. You read about it all the time. They were just amazed by the speed of change. They were very excited by it and also very worried by it. You know, many people got into quite a moral funk over the things that were going on.
Such as?
As always, you know, the new young generations don't seem to be respecting the traditions of the past. It's terrible. People were very worried by the upheaval that happened with so many people so quickly leaving the rural economy and arriving with next to nothing and next to no skills or understanding into the urban situation. And the morals that came out of this sudden dislocation scared people to heck.
Morals, are you talking the kind of things that Dickens highlighted of the poorhouses and child labor, that sort of moral issue, or more personal morality?
More personal morality, but to be fair, you get both. There are people who are disgusted by the way the poor are being treated. Likewise, there are people who are disgusted by the way the poor are behaving. And you can see both things going on at the same time. People in extremis doing what they have to do to survive are both, by some people, understood for the terrible situation they're in, and by other people are just like, you know, it's your own fault. You're poor because you're not work hard enough. It's your fault you're poor. What are you doing? You're immoral. If only you were a decent person, you wouldn't be poor. There's an awful lot of that sort of sentiment.
It's funny how industry and manufactured goods did and didn't work their way quickly into society. Though you describe a job I'd never heard of, was a knocker-upper, a guy who would come around. Many working men and women couldn't afford a clock or a watch. Yeah. So this would be a guy with a watch who would come and tap on your window every morning at 5:30 or whatever time it was you needed to rise.
Yeah, absolutely. There was one woman in London who made her living by giving the time. She'd inherited a watch from her father, so her job was to walk around all the businesses in central London and let them set their clocks by her watch.
Kimberly in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Kimberly, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hello.
I am Jamaican, and my skin is dark, but I love the Victorian era. I'm curious to know if I would have fit in Victorian England.
A dark-skinned a person of African heritage. We'll get it, Kimberly, but tell us first, why do you love the Victorian era? I'm curious, Kimberly.
I was raised on, all things British. My mom, Jamaica is a very classic society there, British heritage.
Yes.
We were a protectorate for a long time.
Yes.
I loved the idea of corsets and bustles. And, and my mom spoke, of how many crinolines she had, in fact. And I know that's the 1950s and so forth. But, I've seen the past. I've been fascinated with the movies and the time and, this transition from carriages to cars. And I love it. And let's not forget Downton Abbey.
Of course. It would come. Yeah, it would come. Ruth, put Kimberly, Jamaican, dark complexion, in the streets of London or elsewhere, let's say in the UK, in this Victorian age. Well, how would her place in that era be seen?
Hi, Kimberly. Well, it would have depended where you were. If you're in London, you would have been amongst quite a lot of other dark-skinned people, probably. It was fairly common. There was a community from all over the world living in London and in Bristol and in Cardiff, the big ports of the world. There was a fairly strong cosmopolitan international community, people from all over the world. So you wouldn't have raised any eyebrows at all in those parts of the country. Spread further out, it sort of varied. There wasn't much overt hostility. People from African origin were in Britain in smallish numbers, not huge, fairly sort of small. And as a result, they didn't scare anybody. And therefore, people were fairly relaxed about it. There were, of course, theories about race, but those theories were tended to be held by some people and not by others. And you can see a very reasonable degree of integration going on in quite a lot of sources. Some of the very first film footage taken in Britain is just a camera set up outside a factory, and all the people just come swooming past. And the idea was that that film would then be shown on a Sunday at the local fairground, and they would hope that everybody would come to see themselves on camera. And in amongst those shots, you quite often get dark faces there in amongst the crowd coming out. So dark-skinned people were about of all sorts of heritage. There were pockets of prejudice. There is no doubt about that. But the people who were most strongly prejudiced against were the Irish. They were the group who really scared people and therefore roused people's ire. They were there in the largest numbers, and there was a distinctly strong prejudice against the Irish. And in London, there was also a feeling against Jewish people. There'd been a big influx towards the end of the Victorian period in Ashkenazi Jews coming from Eastern Europe. And again, because of the size of the influx, people got scared. People got nasty.
And what if Victorians had sat with Kimberly watching Downton Abbey? What would they have thought of Downton Abbey? Just a little later.
They'd have thought it was ridiculously posh and ridiculously clean. Posh. I mean, everybody likes a little bit of fun and a little bit of fantasy. It's lovely. But the characters within Downton are very firmly dressed in the very latest of Paris and London fashions. And while such people own such things for going to parties, they didn't wear them every day. It's all a bit cleaned up and poshed up, is Downton.
Yeah, yeah. Ruth Goodman, please stand by. It's wonderful to have you. The new book is How to Be a Victorian, a Dawn to Dusk Guide to Victorian Life. Ruth Goodman, very well known in the UK for her television roles on the BBC, diving into all kinds of settings, Tudor and Edwardian and Victorian, for a personal, up-close experience of life in those times. Little Pirates of Penzance here from Gilbert and Sullivan, 1879. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
For my military knowledge, though I'm plucky and adventury, has only been brought down to the beginning of the century. But still in matters vegetable, animal and mineral, I am the very model of a modern major general.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about how to be a Victorian. It's the title of Ruth Goodman's book. English-British historian joins us today from Oxford, well-known in the UK for all of her BBC sort of reenacting shows of life on a Tudor monastery farm, an Edwardian farm, in a Victorian pharmacy, on a Victorian farm, wartime farm. She's taken British viewers to many corners of history in a very vivid way. We have all kinds of glimpses of that time. Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre came out. 1847 was seen as a protest against Victorian views on class and gender. In the 2011 film adaptation, Mia Wasikowska plays Jane. Here she talks with her love interest, Mr. Rochester, played by Michael Fassbender, whom Victorian society deemed better than her in both class and gender.
Am I a machine without feelings? Do you think that because I am poor, obscure, plain and little, that I am soulless and heartless? I have as much soul as you and full as much heart. And if God had blessed me with beauty and wealth, I could make it as hard for you to leave me as it is for I to leave you. I'm not speaking to you through mortal flesh. It is my spirit that addresses your spirit, as if we'd passed through the grave and stood at God's feet equal.
Jane Eyre, speaking up there, what about roles of men and women in daily life in this time, Ruth?
They're pretty different, aren't they? The Victorian era is a moment in which a theory about men and women comes to the fore, a theory of separate spheres, that men and women were utterly different and that they had different spheres of influence, that their very bodies were different and the way their minds were wired were different, and that one could never do what the other did, that women, as weaker, gentler vessels, were also more moral, supposedly, and more loving and caring, whereas men were stronger, tougher, cleverer, but that they could sometimes, in battling with the world, lose their way and needed the moral compass of the female to bring them back online. So there is something about it which offers both men and women a way of feeling good about themselves, but there are also many parts of it that allow a great deal of suppression, I suppose.
Were there many who resonated with Charlotte Bronte's view put in the mouth of Jane Eyre there, that there were real problems here with class and gender, roles?
I think there must have been. It's difficult, isn't it, because we don't have everybody's thoughts about it, so we can't sort of take a survey, unfortunately. But of people who were shouting out loud, there were quite a lot of voices who were shouting about class, about gender. I mean, after all, the Victorian period is the one that produces the women's rights movement. It is the one that produces the fight for equal representation for men and then later on for women in Parliament. After all, for most of the Victorian period, the vast majority of Victorian men did not have the vote either.
Tom in Burlington, Vermont. Tom, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Ruth. This subject's really been foremost in my mind. It's funny, as I do my yoga this morning, I actually have a book that's a Victorian architecture book open. And that was before the show started.
Are you standing on your head, Tom?
Absolutely not. I don't do that much anymore.
Okay. Okay.
Give it
What's it leave you thinking?
So I happen to be developing an 1880s building and saying to myself, should I be promoting technological regression for people, you know, this notion that we don't need 3 computers, 4 cars, you know, 5 bathrooms, whatever, that that there's something, you know, to be offered from this horsepowered age, and, you know, recognizing fully that coal was really powering it to a large degree also. And but what was funny, what came up for me in the middle of your discussion,
yes,
was my thought about India as I did my yoga and thinking about the East and the West, and thinking about these hoops and garters and, you know, stays and all of that. And the Indians, with their notion of having a physical regimen that supports the body, and the people in the West going towards this kind of scientific, technological manner of supporting, you know, society,
yeah,
and how different they were, and that interaction between Britain, in India at that time.
Tom, I love it. And women, at least, literally wrapping their bodies in steel in those corsets. A couple of things there, Ruth. I mean, there's East and West. Of course, the empire was growing and pouring wealth into the UK as well at this time. But what about Tom doing his yoga and thinking about tech regression as possibly a positive thing as he listens to a description of the Victorian era? You've lived it out as far as you could. Do you recommend tech regression or not?
Perhaps in part. I think there's something to be said for cherry picking bits and bobs out of the past. I wouldn't want to go back there permanently. I mean, you know, children having to work because they need to eat. The hunger, the disease, it just doesn't bear thinking about. It's really unpleasant. But there are things that, you know, you can cherry pick out and say, oh, do you know, that is a really good way of doing things. Why aren't we doing it? So, I mean, some of it seems very petty and simple, but it was doing historical laundry, not actually for the Victorian, actually for an earlier period. I was doing Tudor historical laundry when I realised that I don't need any detergents or soaps in it. I don't need any chemicals whatsoever. I haven't done my modern washing with anything. I just put it in the washing machine completely with nothing, just with water, and it all still comes out clean. It's the physical force that cleans it, not the chemicals. So I've just done away with a whole load of chemicals. And increasingly, I found that you know, some of the techniques of the past, the Victorians particularly, gave me a great deal of confidence about using chemicals at home in a whole range of ways, about understanding what is in a product, what is not in a product, what does it do? Mm-hmm. Do I want it to do that? You know, making informed choices rather than just doing as I'm told by the adverts is something I found very personally positive from these experiences.
I love the details in here. Toothbrushes, yes, you say, but the bristles generally made of horse or pony hair. Those don't sound too bristly to me.
You don't want anything too coarse. If you were to use pigs, that the length, if you think about the length of hair on a toothbrush, it's not very long, is it?
No.
So if you use something like a pig's bristle, because it's got no room to flex, it would be very, very scrubby. It would be too much. Pony hair particularly is much softer, so you'll get that tiny little length. You will get a bit of movement, and that makes it much softer around the gums. So no, pony hair's good.
Pony hair toothbrush, bring it on. Mm-hmm. Jill writes to us here on our website. She says, it's shocking that people would believe what the doctors, promoters, and shopkeepers told them was true back in the Victorian age. Of course, she notes the same thing. But there are some amazing details in here about what people were using for medicine, about how they understood the body and the whole idea of medicine.
Yeah, it's a period of enormous change. As I say, the whole idea of germs, of bacteria, is one that gets newly accepted within the Victorian period. And that, of course, changes the way we do hygiene as well as the way we do medicine in a general way. Enormous number of ideas about what particular drugs do or do not do to the body, what is safe to use, what's not safe to use. You know, mercury used to be in, you know, a vast array of the products on the pharmacy shelf. Now it's not.
Lucky for us.
Yeah, thank goodness for that, eh?
Oh, Albert in Houston, Texas is calling. Hi, Albert, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, it seems to me that the Victorian era had a real explosion of plurality of religious options, just with the reestablishment of the Roman Catholic Church and the rise of Methodism and so forth. And I just wondered if you could talk a bit about what it must have been like to be a sort of traditional Church of England churchgoer confronted by this new marketplace of religion.
Thank you, Albert. Ruth?
That is a hard question, that one. I think in general, the response of the established church was slightly nervous. I think they were a little bit concerned by, we saw so many people going with Methodism and Baptism and so forth, and seeing how vibrant these alternative church communities were, and feeling a little bit stayed and stuck in the mud themselves, that the established church had become very much associated with the establishment, with the wealthier people, the people in power. And many people who were not of the wealthy and not in power felt pushed out. And therefore, they found the other forms of religious much more welcoming. So there was a sort of bewildered looking about by the Church of England, I think, and an attempt to reinvent itself and to refind its spiritual core and its spiritual enthusiasm and find a new way of trying to speak to its congregations. It's a moment of renewal, really, for the established church.
And Victoria herself, how was she seen, described? I mean, she gives her name to a whole great age here. Did people pay a lot of attention to the monarch?
Yes and no. It goes through phases. Everything has fashions, doesn't it? You know, when she's first on the throne, she's beautiful, she's very young, she's very attractive, she looks innocent, pure, a real contrast to the Georges that had come before, who on the whole had been somewhat older, somewhat fatter, somewhat less moralistic in some of their behaviours. You know, there'd been a lot of mistresses. Mm. Whereas Victoria seemed very pure, very young, very beautiful, and then, of course, she marries Albert straight away, and it's very much a respect relationship. And at that early point, people are very enthusiastic about the new queen. But then it begins to fade. It begins to fade. And there's quite a long period in which, you know, she's obviously not the person pushing fashion. People are a bit worried about the way she's influencing politics. You know, it sort of disappears for a bit. But at the end of her life, enthusiasm for the queen arises again. And I think that's more out of, she'd been there for a blinking long time. She had stuck it out year after year after year. And that feeling of duty and loyalty and permanence was important to people.
People always think about the uptight notions about sexuality in the Victorian era, but know that there's another side to that as well. You write at some length about Victorian ideas about male sexuality, about female sexuality. Compare and contrast.
Well, again, we're talking a lot of change. At the beginning of the period, most people would have said that women have enormous sexual appetite. But as a young woman, it's unawakened. As a virgin, you know nothing about it. You're totally innocent. You have no feelings in that way. But it's come the wedding night, boom, the floodgates are opened, and a woman becomes very keen on all matters of the bed. And men were seen as needing to control that, hold it back. But that idea, however, was beginning to go out of fashion quite quickly. And gradually through the Victorian period, we see a new idea of women as less sexual becoming more common. Meanwhile, throughout the whole period, something about male sexuality remains the same. People saw a man's physical energy bound up with his sperm. So that if a man had sex too often, he spent his sperm, he would actually debilitate himself and make himself effeminate. So if you saw a bloke who was very camp in the street, who was very effeminate in his behaviour, what you would think was that man's had too much sex. It would have sapped his masculinity. Whereas a man who restrained himself and had sex about once a week, he would remain truly masculine.
And yet they were quite ready in the way life actually worked to think about all kinds of what you describe as healthy combination of sexual outlets, wife, mistress, and prostitutes.
Yeah, for men, yeah. You do get a bit of that. There's a number of doctors who moan, actually, that men are coming to them claiming all sorts of various health problems and expecting to get a prescription of go and find yourself a mistress. So some doctors feel pushed into a corner by that. Others just gaily, quite happily, do recommend, go and get yourself a mistress, mate. You're not having enough sex.
So publicly, a kind of primness, and privately, not so much. How would you compare it to the way we handle sexuality today?
Yes, there is an element. And I think, again, just like nowadays, there's more than one opinion going on at the same time. Not everybody has the same outlook. You know, there were people who felt very comfortable with the idea of both sexes having sexual appetites. There was others who felt less comfortable with it. Certain types of sexual behaviour were more acceptable than other types. And that, you know, varied between social groups. So, you know, there is some sort of indication that amongst the very poorest in the East End of London, there was a much more fluid sort of approach to sex. An awful lot of East End young girls would have their first sexual experience 14, 15, usually with a young man of similar age that they knew locally, and then would, from that point of view, then take an older, become the mistress of an older man for money for a period of time, might slip into prostitution for a bit, might not, and then might slip out of that world and back into what we might call a respectable married situation, sort of sometime in her mid-20s. And although it wasn't necessarily approved of within that East End London culture, it was sort of tolerated, that sort of behaviour.
Rachel in Oklahoma asks, what about the American influence on this culture in that time? The U.S. was rising, kind of rambunctious, and certainly coming up. Was there a cultural backwash to the UK?
The beginning period, not so much. It builds, as you would expect, wouldn't you? It builds through the 19th century mm-hmm. so that you start to see more and more American influences coming in all sorts of ways and shapes and things. Perhaps the most fundamental is a basic economic one. From about 1880, with steamships getting so much better and the agriculture of the United States really beginning to be a powerhouse of the world, huge quantities of grain started being shipped across the Atlantic. And that had an enormous impact on Britain because it undercut what British farmers could do by quite some way. So that meant that British farming, British agriculture, just went into crisis right across Britain, something from which arguably it's never recovered. And the price of food, the basic foods, bread, plummeted. And that meant that, you know, we could feed more people better within our cities. Well, you know, that's one heck of a big influence. It might just be an economic one rather than a cultural one, but boy, did it change British culture.
Take that plus the sewing machine and you've got a little bit of American stamp.
Absolutely. What an amazing invention is the sewing machine.
Yeah. Ruth Goodman, this has really been fun and we've barely scratched it, but you're so kind to share some time with us. Behind us here, Mr. Porter, Victorian Music Hall classic. Ruth Goodman, historian Ruth Goodman's book is How to Be a Victorian, a dawn to dusk guide to Victorian life. Ruth, thank you so very much.
Thank you so much, Tom. It's been fun.
It has. Thanks for joining us, listeners. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
What shall I do? I want to go to Birmingham and they're taking me on to crew. Send me back to London as quickly as you can. Oh, Mr. Porter, what a silly girl I am.
Oh, Mr. Porter, what shall I do? I want to go to Birmingham and they're taking me off to crew. Send me back to London as quickly as you can. Oh, Mr. Porter, what a silly girl I am.